Thanks for joining us. It's Sunday and it's 5 o'clock. That means it's time for the Featured Artist Profile. This is a great show. Show where we get an opportunity to listen to a CD cover to cover, some of the hottest Christian music from around the globe. In my fortress,
I will trust. Well, it's time for another Featured Artist Profile. This is Ken Watmore, your host, and I'm here with probably one of my favorite guests of all time, and I'll elaborate on that. It's Lou Gramm, lead singer-songwriter from Foreigner and now the Lou Gramm Band. Lou, how are you?
I'm doing real well, Ken. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I am so excited to get a chance to talk to you because this is a story that I and I know my listeners want to hear. I'm just going to go back a little bit and say why it's exciting for me. I will tell you, Lou, and this is probably a story that you've heard a million times over, but for me, you're the jukebox hero guy. I mean, when boomboxes first came out, that song was like the anthem of my generation. It was such an exciting thing to listen to Foreigner 4 over and over and over again. I'm sure that's common for you here.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It was extremely exciting to play it live and feel the audience reaction and response to that particular song.
Yeah, for whatever reason, I mean, you've got hit after hit, and I know that this show that we do isn't to talk about accolades or anything, but I mean, literally, reality is reality. Your band and you even solo just have one hit after another, and you've been blessed with a gift to write songs and then to perform them. But for whatever reason, that song was just an epic song for the times.
Thank you.
Do you
appreciate that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I know you still perform a lot of your Foreigner stuff. Do you still get that same kind of reaction with songs like that, or Cold as Ice, or things like that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think the recognition factor of for Cold as Ice, the piano intro and things like that. It's the immediate recognition and people just cheer it. Yeah. There's applause and people are cheering. It's part of their life, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know what's funny is that just going back through your bio, because I forget all the different songs that are from Foreigner and from you personally, and the song that I hear playing over and over in my head as I think about different moments that were emotionally moving for our country and even all over the world, it's probably timely to say this, I guess, but that song, I Want to Know What Love Is, it seems like that song plays over and over again whenever I hear of, you know, these different things going on in the world.
Yes, it does, and it's you know, it could be taken as a personal one-to-one love song or something far bigger than that, you know, it's just the type of song that you can almost pray to.
Yeah, it's a great song, great stuff. Well, let's kind of just a prelude to what I really want to talk to you about. I do want to kind of lead up to, you know, tell us about Lou Gramm. I mean, we can all read the bio, and I do want to encourage, for sure, all of our listeners, we want to encourage them to pick up your latest album. It's great stuff, and they can all go to lougramm.com with two M's. I want everybody to check out lougramm.com, and they can all read your bio and learn a little bit about you. But I want to talk to you about, you know, kind of how you got into this rock and roll thing, when it struck you that, you know, this is what you were going to do, and let's kind of walk through that area first.
That sounds good. My mom and dad were both musicians. My dad was a jazz trumpet player and had his own big band, and my mom was the singer, and that's how they met and fell in love and were married, and I'm the second of three kids. Mm-hmm. And we grew up in a very musical house, and there was always music of that time on the radio, Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra, Harry James Band, Count Basie, you know, all of that stuff. So I grew up with that kind of music in the house. However, I remember very vividly seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan for the first time. And I think that really just clicked something inside of me, and I knew, I think, at that moment that's what I wanted to my life's work to be, you know.
Yeah.
I think I saw the Beatles when I was 11 or 12 years old. I had already been playing drums for about 4 years, and was singing in the elementary school chorus. A few years later, I had my own young band, and I was playing drums and singing, and we began to work on original songs, and the band became Black Sheep, and we ultimately were signed first to Chrysalis Records, the first American act signed to Chrysalis Records.
Uh-huh.
That's it, and that's it. That's a European label that's very strong in Europe, and they were trying to break through in the States. And that really didn't work out for them. Subsequently, didn't work out for us, but we were picked up by Capitol Records, which was great, and we released two albums on Black Sheep. And at the end of promoting the second album, I got a call from Mick Jones saying that he was putting together. I met Mick when Spooky Tooth, the band he was playing with, played in Rochester. I was lucky enough to meet him and Gary Wright and some of the other guys in the band. Mm-hmm. At any rate, Mick called me about a year later and said that he was putting together his own band and asked me if I wanted to come and audition. Well, I was pretty much tied up in Black Sheep. That was my band, and I thanked him for the offer, but told him that I wanted to just continue what I was doing, and he said he would call back in another month or two and see if anything had changed. Well, wouldn't you know it, we were opening for Kiss.
Oh, cool.
That was we were on the Kiss tour, and we had played the Orpheum in Boston, and on the way back to Rochester on Christmas Eve, the truck slid off the New York State Thruway and rolled over.
Oh, man.
Fortunately, the three setup guys that were in the truck were, although they were bumped and bruised, nobody was hurt, but the equipment was pretty much, I'd say, about 75% to 80% destroyed.
Oh.
And we tried to beg, borrow, and steal, well, not quite steal, but, some equipment to get us going back on the tour, and we couldn't. And it turns out that the insurance company, this again, like I said, this was at the end of December, the insurance company settled with us in March.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so we not only lost the opening slot in the Kiss tour, But Capitol Records dropped us because we weren't able to promote our own album by playing.
Oh, man. That's the worst storm.
Yeah, and 2 weeks later, Mick calls again. Just wanted to see how things were going. Would you consider coming down and auditioning? And I told him I'd call him back, and I told the guys in Black Sheep. And they said, "What are you crazy? You know, this we had great prospects, but basically this band is over. Go see what you can do. You know, at least one of us will get out of Rochester."
Yeah.
So I went. Yeah, right. So I went down to New York and auditioned. Apparently, I was about the 43rd or 44th singer to audition, I was told. And although they didn't tell me if I was in or if I was out, I stayed there for another week or 10 days with one change of clothes.
Wow.
I kept, while I was wearing one, I'd wash the other. And finally I was writing with Mick, and we were working on new songs. And I said, you know, I've been wearing two sets of clothes for this whole time. I says, you guys got to tell me, am I in or not? I've got to go home, you know? And they said, "Oh yeah, I thought you knew you were in. You're in, you know."
Oh, that's
so great. So, yep. And within a couple of weeks, I had packed up a rental truck and moved to Westchester County, way up in Elmsford, And because I really couldn't afford a New York City apartment, and so I would commute in and out of the city every day, and we would rehearse, and we were passed on by every major label, and then this gentleman who worked for Atlantic Records, John Kolodna, he's a legendary A&R guy, artist relations, and he told Atlantic Records, the president, that Foreigner has the potential to be a huge band, and that he thought that Foreigner should be signed to Atlantic and given a shot. Mm. So we were.
Oh, wow. What a story, man. And that's just the beginning of it all. That must have been probably for some young guys playing in Black Sheep and opening up for Kiss. I mean, boy, talk about being exposed to the underbelly of rock and roll, probably. Not that those guys are the underbelly, just that scene was pretty crazy, right?
Oh, it was insane. We also opened for 10 years after in Detroit and Miami. They were flying, of course, we were opening. As soon as we'd come off the stage, we'd get in a car with our sweaty clothes on and start driving to the next show, which could be halfway across the states.
Right.
Yeah, with our truck about an hour behind us with our equipment, and half the time we would end up being in the city where the next show was about an hour and a half before we're supposed to go on.
Wow, not the glamour that everybody thinks it is to be a rock and roller, at least not in the beginning, right?
No, it really was a struggle to survive. We spent more money on gas and we would rent a hotel room with a double bed, and then the rest of the band would sneak in the back door. We'd take the mattresses off the box springs, and there'd be four people sleeping on two box springs and another four people sleeping on the mattresses.
Right. Wow.
And then we'd buy a newspaper and cut out the coupon for these all you can eat buffets.
Yeah, absolutely.
and that's how we existed.
That is something else. Well, fast forwarding a little bit, you get signed with Foreigner. You get the audition, you get the spot, you guys get signed. Moving forward, you cut an album and go out there. Was it just immediate as soon as you guys got out there on the road and had that first album out that it was immediate fanfare?
I think it was. We had Feels Like the First Time and Cold as Ice, one following the other, race up into the top 10 of the charts.
Yeah.
And the album was selling at a really good pace. And we were opening for the Doobie Brothers that mm-hmm. summer, and they were very popular then. So every show that we played with them was packed, and I think we made a lot of new fans. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Great band to be riding with. That's excellent. So with that, I'm gonna just jump ahead a little bit more and go to 81 when Foreigner 4 comes out. Now you're really at the top of the game, and tell me what's a day in the life of Lou Gramm or any other band member at a Foreigner, in 82, 83, right after that band, that album has hit and become, really your signature.
Well, I think that it was real apparent. We knew it, and the record company knew it, that it was a monumental album for us in terms of the kind of music we were playing and reshaping ourselves, making a giant step for ourselves after three good rock albums. We took the next step, I think, if we were going to really sell this album and make our mark with this album, we knew we were going to have to tour like we had never toured before. And, uh, And as the songs were racing up and down the charts on that album, we had Atlantic Records really pushing it. We were doing days and days of interviews and then going on stage at night. We were on the road doing shows and promoting that album for over a year and a half straight.
Go ahead, sorry.
You know, it really... You know, by the time we approached 9 or 10 months, we were just burned out.
Yeah. Well, so it's not like the you still haven't. I think you were gonna say you still haven't recovered.
Yeah, it just wasn't like the glory of the first album. You know, we were out for 3 or 4 months with the Doobies and then back in the studio to do Double Vision. This one was grinding it out, and I really have to say that as much as I loved the album, I was tired of singing all those songs, all of them. Yeah. You know, and I just wanted to go home to my wife and my kids who I wouldn't see for 5 or 6 weeks and then be home for a day or two and then back on the road.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go next, is that it's I think that probably a lot of us have visions that, you know, all these rock and roll stars are hanging out on the beach and, you know, relaxing and enjoying their millions. And there's a real drag on a person who's out living this lifestyle, especially when they have a family. And when you have a family, goodness gracious, there must be some longing on the road.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I would, you know, there really weren't cell phones right. yet at that time. And you would have to make your calls through the hotel. And particular hotels would charge what they wanted to charge. And I could remember talking to my wife and my kids for an hour and a half, hour and three quarters, and have a $350 bill waiting the next morning before I checked out.
Wow!
Just for the phone call.
Yeah.
I think it's that longing and that heartache inside of you could lead. It led me to drink and drug.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just be someplace else, you know.
Yeah. So
I'd had enough of what was considered maintaining success.
Yeah. So how hard was that? I mean, when you developed a habit for, you know, drinking and taking drugs. I mean, how hard was that to break away from? I mean, that becomes kind of a third world. You've got this world of, I'm trying to deal with everything through this vehicle of drinking or drugs, but then you've got the family life, and then you've got the, I'm Lou Gramm, you know, lead singer songwriter for Foreigner. You've got to play those three different parts. How does that play into it, and where does it kind of get muddy?
It would get muddy in every way, shape, or form. You know, I think that everything would suffer. Not only the performances, but the phone calls would just be, you know, very depressed phone calls. You know, and when you're doing that stuff, your phone calls would become less and less.
Yeah.
You know, because you really didn't, the attitude on the phone was so down that eventually we didn't want to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And tempers were short when people were walking on stage with the residuals of what they had done the night before.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Well, somewhere along the line, and I know there's another pretty major thing that happened in the 90s with you, with your health, and I want to talk about that, but I do want to ask this question first. Somewhere along the line, Christ became really real to you in your life. And that's the meat of the conversation I want to get into. And that's, you know, what what made you say, you know, I believe, you know, Christ is there. I believe he's my savior. And what made you follow him? You made that choice somewhere.
It was in a hotel room in New York City. And it was the morning after we had played a sold out show at Madison Square Garden. And the reviews were fantastic, and we had sold mountains of merchandise, and you know, it was just about as wonderful for the band as a whole as it could be, you know. But of course the after show parties lasted into the morning of the next day, and when I got in my hotel room, I was a mess. I looked at myself and I knew that I was ruining my life, and that I was at risk of losing my family and quite possibly my life. I was supposed to have caught a plane home, and I knew that I just by looking at myself and knowing how I was feeling that I wouldn't have been able to go to the airport and get through security. I was that bad.
Wow.
So I called my attorney, who was a friend of mine, uh-huh. and let him. He knew about my addiction, and let him know that I was not in good shape, and asked him if he could look for a place for me to go, uh-huh. and I had remembered that someone had told me about a place called Hazleton in Minnesota, and that they really help, and more than many of these places that are just a dry out, they work towards educating you about the long-term effects of addiction, and have speakers. Different people in all walks of life who you wouldn't think about as ever being addicted, but were, and they would speak to the body of Hazleton, and I went there, and I spent 31 days there, and met some wonderful people, and told my story a number of times, And I've had 19 years of sobriety at this point in my life.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And at Hazleton, they also had pastors there for all religions, In that time there, when my mind cleared and I realized that I couldn't go on like this, I knew that my ability to keep clean was not strong, and that I couldn't do it. I gave my heart to the Lord, and I knew that His strength would get me through.
Well. That's awesome. It's evident in the all the lyrics of this latest Lou Gramm Band album. You know, the song, even the song titles, you know, Made to be Broken and Redeemer and Willing to Forgive, and you know, that's the way God planned it. I mean, it just goes on and on, and I love the You Saved Me title. I mean, it's basic and the truth, right? And there's nothing better than the truth, but He saved us, and he saved you, and from what a thing. So How did your family react to this? I mean, and I'm step by step here. Just first, the fact that you didn't make the plane home. At some point, you had to tell your wife, "I'm checking myself in," and then to the point yep. where you said, "Hey, you know what? I gave my life to Jesus Christ. What do you think about that?"
I think that's where the friction began. Mm. So some people were ultimately very pleased about that, and surprisingly, some were not.
Yeah.
Unbelievably, my wife was not pleased.
Wow.
And my bandmates were not pleased. But I knew that that's what I had to do. And you know, we did tour again, and I had the back lounge to myself while they were 20 feet away in the front lounge doing lines.
Yeah.
And drinking Stolichnaya all night.
Huh.
And as a new Christian and with my sobriety still new, it was horrible. You know, it was a nice lounge and a nice place to be to get away from everything and everybody, but at some point it became a cell for me.
Wow.
It became a jail cell.
So what do you do after that? I mean, did you say to the guys, you know, I can't do it anymore?
Yeah, basically. Now, you know, I want to say that a few years later, my main bandmate and founder of the band, Rick Jones, rehabbed also and cleaned himself up for a few years. Mm. And so then touring wasn't so bad because he didn't drink or use anymore. Then the bus was spotlessly clean and nobody could.
Yeah.
In the bus. But when he was using and I was the only one who was clean and sober, I was relegated to the back lounge. Mm. And a few years later, we were performing, just the two of us, in something called Night of the Proms, and it was with the Prague Symphony Orchestra.
Wow.
And the writers, singers, and guitar players for a number of bands. There was also Michael McDonald, the Pointer Sisters, and just a slew of acts. And we were playing these 45,000 indoor tennis arenas throughout Europe. And he fell off the wagon.
Mm.
We would be on stage and playing Cold as Ice, backed up by the orchestra, and the beginning piano thing was unrecognizable, and it was really bad. And our manager was there, and I told our manager that when this is over, he has to go right back into rehab again, or I'm going to just move on at this point.
Yeah.
And so our manager set up a rehab, and everything looked like it was going to work out. And I flew home, and so did the manager. And Mick never showed up.
Man, what a shame.
Yep, and for the next 4 or 5 years, he was just, you know, I just notified him that I couldn't be around that, and I can't work with anybody who does that. We had nothing in common, you know.
Yeah.
And I hear he really is clean and sober now, and has been for a number of years. But I think there's been too much water under the bridge, and I'm real satisfied with the band I'm in. And although, you know, it's not Foreigner and the big money and the all that other baloney, but there's more to life than that, and I enjoy what I'm doing right now a lot.
Yeah. So just want to touch on one more thing. Somewhere in this, in the midst of all this, and I don't know the timeline necessarily, but I mean, you had a significant medical happening, and you had a brain tumor.
Yes, I did. So I had cleaned up in 91. Uh-huh. And in 97, while we were touring, it was actually just towards the end of the America tour, before we were due to go to Japan and the Far East, I had been waking up in the morning with headaches that made my old hangovers look like nothing.
Oh.
You know, and these headaches were so debilitating that I couldn't figure out what it was. And other symptoms were, I would go to call my mom and dad, who had the same number for over 20 years, and I'd dial the prefix, and the last four numbers wouldn't come to me, to the point where I had to look them up in my little phone book to be able to call my mom and dad. And I thought to myself, dear Lord, what's going on? And I went to a doctor in Rochester. They have really good doctors in Rochester. Had an MRI and saw a non-cancerous tumor, but it was the size of an egg in my frontal lobe. It had tentacles wrapped around my optic nerve and my pituitary. Oh. And the doctors in Rochester suggested that I go to someone who specializes this in New York. So I flew there, and the doctor did his own MRIs and told me that he thought it was too far gone and that I should just go home.
Wow.
So
that seems like it would be what do you do? I mean, that seems like the biggest letdown in the world, to have a doctor tell you too bad.
Yeah. Yep. He said he would operate on it, but there was more of a chance I would die during the operation, or if the operation was successful, I might be so damaged that I wished that I hadn't lived through it.
Hmm.
So I went home thinking that my time here was very, very short. And I happened to turn on, I think it was on a Monday night, 2020. And there was a segment on it about Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and a Dr. Black, who was the purveyor of laser surgery and is able to remove brain tumors that were previously considered to be inoperable.
Wow.
And at the end of the segment, it actually had his office telephone number on it. So I wrote it down. And by 6:30, 6:45 the next morning, I was on the phone with his personal secretary. Told her my situation, and told her I had my MRIs, and she told me that there had been a cancellation on Thursday, and that I should get on a plane that day and get to Boston.
Wow.
And I did. And he told me that time is of the essence. And Thursday morning at 4:45 in the morning, I was being wheeled into the operating room.
For like a 19-hour surgery.
19-hour surgery, and while the anesthesia drip was putting me under, I was in prayer the whole way.
Yeah.
And I woke up at around 11 o'clock that night. And I couldn't believe that I was still alive. Although the next 4 or 5 years made me wonder if I should be alive or not.
Hmm.
Because it was the aftermath of the operation really was living hell.
Oh, really? So physically, things that you had to kind of recoup and all that kind of stuff, is that what you mean?
Well, my head was swollen for at least almost a year from the surgery. You know, my head looked like a big round ball on top of my shoulders. Mm. I had no definition in it, and it was the steroids too that basically were doing that. I was on massive, massive steroids. And within 6 months, I had gained 130 pounds.
Whoa.
From the steroids. Most of my adult life, I was 145 pounds. I went up to about 270 pounds.
Wow.
And I couldn't think clearly. I had to search for every word that came out of my mouth. There was no natural, no natural speaking to someone. It was broken sentences, and I developed such an intense sleep apnea that I would be sitting talking to someone. Anyone, and if there was a lull in the conversation, my eyes would close and I would be asleep.
Wow. I can't even imagine.
And I fell asleep 3 times behind the wheel. I didn't know what I had. I know I was just tired. I would sleep and I would wake up in the morning feeling more tired than before I went to sleep. And I got in 2 head-on collisions, and one time went off the road. And thank God no one was killed. But there were some people that were injured. And I voluntarily turned in my license.
Mm.
And right after the operation, I was married and I was blessed with twins, a boy and a girl. And 3 years later, she was so disillusioned from the person that she fell in love with to the person that I had become. I was playing a show and I came home and the house was empty.
Oh man. So you were still able to play shows I guess not for a few years at least though.
I was playing shows. The operation was March of 97. I was playing shows by September.
Wow.
Because I shouldn't have been doing anything, but I was told by management and booking agents that there were shows that were booked and we were responsible for, and we were liable for massive lawsuits if we didn't deliver.
Wow.
So I went on stage looking. There's pictures floating around of the way I looked that year on stage. And I couldn't remember the words to any of the songs. I had the words written down on the floor, taped to the floor.
Hmm.
And there would be jeering shouts from the audience. Hey, Lou, really hitting that pasta, aren't you?
Man. Nothing like a fan, right, to warm your day.
Yeah, and you know, I it was a living hell. Hmm. And I would ask the Lord why he let me live, so I would go through this, you know.
Yeah. So what, and where do you find peace in that, Lou? I mean, after you asked the Lord for that, obviously there was some time before you got any kind of resolve. And I feel like listening to your album now that I feel like you do have a peace with the Lord based on your song content and your lyrics. And, I mean, is that what I get out of this? And is that what our listeners should get, is that God has blessed you with a peace about it now? Do you still struggle with that?
What happened, about 2001, or maybe 2002, which was about 5 years after the operation. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the years after that was, you know, besides the sleep apnea and the heavy medication, I really was walking around in a fog all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. My thinking was not clear. My cognizance, everything. I didn't understand what people were saying. That, you know, it just was like people in the band had to take care of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was I had to hire people to make sure I took my medication and so on and so forth. And that people came on the road with me to make sure that I did what I was supposed to do. And about 2002, the fog started to lift a little at a time.
Hmm.
Since around that time, I was living alone again, you know?
Yeah.
And being able to see the twins very rarely because of my condition.
Sure.
And not even alone. I had to have someone there with me. And things just started slowly getting better. I could tell that I was getting better. And I just was as patient as I could be. And people started telling me that I was getting better. My sentences were succinct. I was listening, able to listen and understand what people were saying and respond without there being a 35 or 40 second gap in between there while I was trying to put together some words.
Yeah.
You know, as the Synthroid the doctor started backing off on that. Weight started coming off. You know, I was in control enough to go on a reasonable diet. I was able to work out again after not working out for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And just within the last 2 years, my round face finally started to have some definition again, and I began to feel, look, and sound like the person that God made me.
Yeah, I can't even imagine, Lou. I'm almost lost for words because it's such a, I want to say tragedy, but you know, we know that for those who love Him, God works things together for good, and I'm,
yep,
you know, and I can't wait to see what He's got for you next. You know, as a result of this, so here's a great album that, you know, that just glorifies Him and speaks to your heart. And, you know, it's going to be exciting to see what's happening next. Do you have some things working now?
Well, we've got a few songs written, but you know, we're touring until at least October. And then we're going to be hard to work on a new album for sure.
Yeah.
So, and that's exciting because I can't wait for what's coming next.
Yeah, absolutely. How is the tour going? I mean, are you back in full swing up there, having a great time?
Yeah, the problem is we had hoped to hook up with a Christian rock tour or be able to play in places where we could do songs from the new album, but you know we still do a lot of casinos and state fairs and things like that, and people just want to hear the hits.
Sure.
You know, so I've been sliding in a song or two every night, you know, a different song or two every night, and even though probably 85% of them had never heard the song before, we're getting really good response for those new songs.
Oh, that's great.
And along with our merchandise, we sell the new album.
That's great.
And the new album's selling real good where we play.
I'm so glad to hear that. Do you have an opportunity with some of the fans? Do they ask these kind of questions where you can share a little bit of that story, kind of share the gospel?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you better believe it. You better believe it.
I would imagine.
And you know, over the years, I've gotten calls from other people who have brain tumors and are not sure where to turn. And I recommend Dr. Black at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and I have the number, and I give them that number, same number I called.
Right.
And I hear back from them every now and then, and obviously some did not make it, but there's quite a few that thank me for the number and say that they're doing well.
Hmm. What a place for God to use you, for sure. Well, Lou, I'm going to just tell all our listeners again to visit lougraham.com with two M's. Probably everybody knows that, but I just want to make sure they go there, lougraham.com. Check out the tour information. There's merchandise available. Everything you want to know and how to get in touch, to follow along and things. It's all on the website there. And pick up this new CD, the Lou Graham Band. It's that's the title of the CD, and it's great stuff. Songs about the Lord, and I love hearing that from you. And I love these kind of stories where, my hope, Lou, is that people who hear this, that maybe there'll be people that wouldn't normally tune in to a Christian radio program, but they see your name and they say, well, gosh, I want to hear about Lou. I want to hear, you know, where he's at and about his life and his testimony, and they get exposed to the gospel of Jesus Christ, that, you know, that's he's the way we're saved and the only way, and he impacts all
that's
of
right.
us. It doesn't matter if you were on stage for the hottest band in the world or if you're, you know, a guy like me who's, you know, in a little studio somewhere or just doing whatever you do. Christ is, he touches us all in our own place.
Yes, he does.
And right when he wants to. So, Lou, thank you so much. This has been a long
thank interview. You, Ken.
I appreciate your time.
No problem at all. I'm glad we talked.
Absolutely. And I'll tell our listeners, we'll be prayerful for you to continue to impact people's lives for Jesus Christ through your music and through
thank
the
you.
Opportunities you have. Well, have a,
excellent. Thanks.
Have a great day. We'll look for you on tour, Lou.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks so much. See you later.
Bye now.